It is the Federal News Countdown, and it is not just a Federal News Countdown. It is the final Federal News Countdown of 2013, and I am pleased to have on the final Federal News Countdown of 2013, Roger Baker of Agilex, the former CIO at the Department of Veterans Affairs. It is great to see you, my friend. Thanks
for
coming in.
Good to be back in the glass-enclosed center here.
It is a little bit of an unusual countdown, too, in the respect that because it's your first Federal News Countdown, and it is the final countdown of 2013, it's just going to be you and me today.
Sounds like fun.
You've chosen your three most important Federal News stories of the week. And we have those linked up later today at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. And I have done the same thing. We've looked at all of the things that the government's dealing with this week. And we will start, Roger, where we always start, with
number three.
The third most important Federal News story of the week, as you have selected, is from the New York Times. The headline is FDA questions safety of antibacterial soaps. And I imagine this is not just because that you like the way that the soaps make your hands feel moist that you've chosen the story as your third most important story of the week, Roger.
Well, so as you can imagine, at VA, I got a lot of exposure to the FDA. And as we think about government and all the things that are being slung at federal employees, I really like this one. It's a little controversial. For years everybody's been hearing that we should be utilizing antibacterial soaps, but this is a great, to me, story at the nexus of scientific method and governmental approval methods. What the FDA is saying is there's not enough evidence out there to indicate that these antibiotic soaps actually do stop sickness from occurring, and if they don't, then they're contributing to the issue of us being resistant to the antibiotics that we're going to need to stay healthy in the future. And so, when you think about the FDA and the role we ask those great federal employees to play, it's, get out there and protect us from things that we don't know might be a problem from us. So I love this one because it's an example of government doing what government should do. It's not an easy decision. You can imagine what the agonizing over this decision was inside of the federal agency. But somebody made, to me, the right call here, even if it is just to go look at it and say, I need more evidence before you guys just start proliferating this everywhere.
The story says the chemicals were originally used by surgeons to wash their hands before operations, and their use exploded in recent years as manufacturers added them to a variety of products, including mouthwash, laundry detergent, fabrics, and baby pacifiers. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention found the chemicals in the urine of 75% of Americans.
Yeah.
So this stuff is indeed everywhere, and I wonder that if the chemicals stick around with you long enough to be passed that way, then it strikes me, as you're saying, that this is something that certainly deserves more scrutiny.
Yeah, and I think, if you think about prescription drugs and all the things that eventually, make it out into our water supply, even if they're things that, that the body is processing, some amount of that makes it out and into the water supply, and I think you've got a good idea how that occurs, and the purification doesn't take those things out.
Yeah.
So, it's kind of sad to think that what comes out of the Potomac has probably got a whole bunch of stuff in it that we're pouring into ourselves.
Another facet of this, Roger, is plays into what you and I have talked about on this program before and that we've discussed off the air on a number of occasions, and that is the fact that it's fine to say the government should do this or should not do that, or the size of the government should be this or that. When it comes down to actually discussing with people what they want and expect the government to do, and you ask them individual things, all of the things that on a broad scale don't seem to be very popular are very popular. If you ask people what they think of the Social Security Administration overall, they like it. If you ask people what they think overall of your former agency, VA, they like it. If you ask people, I'm sure, what they thought of the FDA and the job that they do keeping the food supply safe, they like it. And they want all of these things to continue. And so that it strikes me that any issues that we look at need to go down a layer rather than just here's the government and what size is the government.
Right. I think the thing that bothers me about this discussion is that what is probably a great political discussion, about the size of the government has devolved into something that, where the slogan seems to be government employees bad. And the fact is that if you want to accomplish all these programs that everybody wants, and we could all go through and add lots of other agencies, Department of Transportation, Department of Energy, all these things that we want as citizens, you got to recognize that it's the federal employees that make all these things happen. And as you make working in the federal government less and less attractive to folks, you're going to drive more and more of the good folks out. You know, the fundamental rule of employment is, you know, the good folks can move more quickly than the folks that, you know, that aren't as good. And as you drive those folks out and make it less attractive, you're just not going to be as effective from the accomplishment of the programs. And I think there's a very short-sighted view being taken of federal employees right now that that just isn't appropriate. As a former political, my view was, look, shoot at me all you want. For some crazy reason, I chose this job. But the career employees are just here to do the job the best way they can possibly do it. They didn't come in to support the Republicans or the Democrats. They came in to support the American people.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a real, as you can tell, problem. A lot of these folks are my friends, and I know they work their butts off to do a great job, and it's just not good, you know, to see them constantly fought over in the press.
Roger Baker's third most important federal news story of the week on this week's Federal News Countdowns from the New York Times. FDA questions safety of antibacterial soaps. And that story and all of our stories are linked at federalnewsradio.com /in-depth. My choice for number three this week, Roger, is from WTOP.com. The headline is "Some Target Customers Unable to Get Through to Company." And it's not so much about what this story in particular says, that the customers are having a hard time finding out whether their information was among that information that was stolen by hackers. But the concept that, you spent plenty of time on Capitol Hill talking to members of Congress about issues with security at VA. Your colleagues at other agencies have done the same thing. And there seems to be a perception that it happens in government and it never happens in the private sector. That's gone away a little bit, but I think this Target story is a reminder that some very significant things can happen in the private sector that people think only happen to people who work for the government. It kind of fits with what we were just talking about a moment ago.
Right.
The concept here, what do you see when you look at this Target story? Because this is one of the things that you thought about adding to your list this week.
Yes.
What do you see here that applies to your friends and colleagues in government?
Well, I think you hit it exactly on the nose. You know, cybersecurity is incredibly complex, and it's a tough area. When you look at banks and credit card companies and technology companies and everybody who's trying to protect their networks, you know, the truth is that we're fighting a slowly losing battle. The attackers have only to find one way in. If you look at, I don't want to go a long ways into the VA security. They seem to have made plenty of press lately, but there are over 1 million devices in the VA network. In theory, if one of those devices has a security hole, it creates an avenue in for an attacker to then go and exploit. Now, you practice defense in depth, and you put a lot of things in place, but in the end, there are very sophisticated, very well-trained, and very well-compensated organizations, some of them funded by other nations, that are attacking networks all over the world, including in the United States. It is very, very difficult to protect everything you've got, from those folks. And it's, unfortunately, this is an example of the sort of thing that I think we're just going to continue to see because, again, we're just fighting a slowly losing battle on a security front.
The other element of this that I think is important is not included in this story, but it actually comes via an email that a friend of ours, someone who you would know, forwarded to me this morning. And the gist of this email was, it never ends with this kind of thing, was the message I took away, because as I scrolled down, this message looks like it's from Target. And it says, "Dear guest, we wanted to make you aware of unauthorized access to Target payment card data, blah, 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 blah. We've determined the information included your customer name, da, 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 da." And then, of course, here's links to click if you suspect that this was that your data might be compromised, to find out how to verify that.
Yeah.
And the person who sent me this pointed out that all of the links lead to a site that has nothing to do with Target.
Right. Spoofing is even more productive typically than this kind of attack that the target has seen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the response rates to direct mail are in the low percentages. But if you can get a 4% response to a spoofing email like that, where someone comes in and says, oh, sure, my login to my credit card account is this, and here's my password,
mm-hmm.
you know, you've got the keys to whatever kingdom they've got
yep.
in that piece.
And the cost is infinitely smaller than anything you could have done yep. via direct mail.
Yeah, I liked your point about if you went back and lined up the big ones, you know, not only is there there's Target, but there was the shoe company. A few years back.
Yes. I remember it. And
was it TJ Maxx or?
It was one of those.
One of those. You look at LinkedIn with mm-hmm. the big issue on passwords. If you roll through all of the big incursions, I mean, the good news is that the bulk of those where real data has been achieved have been private sector, you know, incursions. And not to say that government is in any way immune from them or safe from them, but you know, the huge, I think, financially impactful ones to this point have been on the private sector side. You know, knock wood, on behalf of all my brethren in the CIO community, you know, let's hope that the government stays relatively solid from that standpoint. But it is an industry-wide issue. It's not something unique to government or the private sector. It's an industry-wide issue.
One final thought. We're just about out of time for the segment, but one final thought about this that makes me hopeful, I guess, is that for you and your colleagues in government to see this happen in the private sector, and maybe for people on Capitol Hill to see this happen in such a high-profile way in the private sector, we'll do a little bit more toward removing the stigma of this happening, automatically implying that it means you did something wrong, CIO of a federal agency, because you were breached. I have a really hard time believing, with the data that Target deals with and knows that it deals with, that they didn't have a very sophisticated cybersecurity policy and procedure in place, and their infrastructure was probably about as good as you can get, and yet they were still breached. And so what it says about who can be hit and under what conditions, I think, is potentially hopeful that people will start to understand, you know, this sucks. It's an inconvenience. It's not good, but it doesn't necessarily imply that nobody was doing anything about it. People are ambivalent toward it.
Without citing the specific ones, we've all heard about the ones that prove that there is no such thing as a computing asset that cannot be hit by cyber threats.
Roger Baker is my guest on the Federal News Countdown this week. My choice for the third most important federal news story of the week is from WTOP.com about the Target data breach. And you can read all of our stories on the Countdown at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth later this afternoon. Second most important federal news story of the week next on this week's Federal News Countdown. Back in a moment. Welcome back to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. It is the final Federal News Countdown of 2013. My guest on the Countdown today is Roger Baker of Agilex, selecting his three most important federal news stories of the week, and I have done the same thing, and we are up to
number two.
And Roger, your second most important federal news story of the week is Mike O'Connell's story headlined, "What a Waste, Senator Coburn Releases Annual Survey of Wasteful Government Spending." It's Wastebook 2013. And this, as the title implies, he puts this out every year, and he perceives these to be items of wasteful spending. But a number of people around Capitol Hill look at these in a number of different ways, Roger.
Yeah, you know, I contrast it with an article that I found basically the same time over on the NextGov by Marina Corin. Navy technology aims to make fuel out of seawater.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things you learn in the private sector is that not every innovation is going to turn out to be productive. And so there's a fine line. You know, one person's wasteful spending may well be somebody else's innovative attempt at doing something that you know that breaks out. And I think, you know, it kind of goes back to what I was talking about with the FDA antibacterial soaps thing. As you're going to criticize, you know, one of the things that I'm firmly convinced that that a lot of folks in government don't understand is the way that venture capital firms work and the risks that people are willing to take with money, you know, to move forward. I mean, if you're a venture capitalist, you know that a significant percentage of your investments are going to, you know, hit. They're going to crash. Mm-hmm. You're going to get zero out of them. But what you plan on is that one or two of them are going to go 20 to 50 times what you put in, and the net is very, very positive.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't do innovation without taking risk. You can't do innovation without planning on a substantial amount of things that maybe in hindsight look bad. I was speculating on if we were back in the 1970s with this, you know, would somebody say, well, you're looking at creating a network that's just going to send messages off someplace and doesn't get a confirmation back, and you're just going to rely on your message getting there, and it might go a whole bunch of different routes, and that's a stupid idea. And yet that turns into the internet. I can see those sort of things. Innovation involves risk. Risk involves, hey, maybe somebody's going to call this a dumb idea someday.
Mm-hmm.
But one person's dumb idea is somebody else's Facebook.
Yep. There are a lot of elements there of risk and educated risk is a term that I hear thrown around sometimes. But perspective is the one that I think is maybe the most critical in this. For example, the first item that Mike O'Connell writes about in this story is between sequestration, furloughs, government shutdown, and the work or lack thereof of the least productive Congress in history. The 113th Congress only passed 56 laws in its first year. Taxpayers spent $400 million to pay people not to work. And what that's referring to is the government shutdown and the right. fact that the employees were made whole after this 16 days of the government shutdown. So, again, perspective here. I think Senator Coburn's case that we paid people to do nothing on the surface is 100% accurate. People didn't work, but they did collect the money that they would have made. In fact, we did see some dissonance a little bit among the agencies where there were high percentages of people who were deemed to be essential or whatever the appropriate term is and thus worked and got paid. And then their colleagues came back and those people said, well, we worked and they didn't do anything and we still came out the same.
Right.
So there was an issue there. So you can make a case that Senator Coburn is 100% accurate. You can also make a case that what we talked about that FDA story, developing and cultivating and keeping a workforce where people want to come to work and feel valued is potentially worth making this investment in so that the good people, as you said earlier, who could leave choose not to and choose to stay.
Yeah. If you think about every company out there, certainly every technology company out there is focused on what do I do to attract and retain the best talent? And you know, in the end, the government made the right decision here. Saner minds prevailed. They, you know, made certain they made the employees whole. But the whole shutdown, you know, the whole question of would they make them whole, the roll-up of the pension, you know, issues, the roll-up of, you know, will I live under a CR forever, just adds that question in people's minds of should I keep doing this? Is this the right thing for me and my family to do? You know, I was... years ago, I was taking a ride home with another federal CIO, one of the really, really great ones, and he told me he was going to leave because he had several kids in college and needed to make certain that he was going to be able to afford that. And it just, you know, you got to remember that they may be public figures, but they have lives to live as well. And you know, they've got to take care of their family the same way everybody else does. And even if they end up in the middle of a political pawn thing, you know, they've still got to have a paycheck when it gets done. And it's just going to drive folks out if you don't make certain you're doing the right things for them.
Roger Baker's second most important federal news story of the week is Michael O'Connell's story from federalnewsradio.com. What a waste. Senator Coburn releases annual survey of wasteful government spending. My second most important story of the week is headlined, Senate Confirms Turnaround Specialist to Head IRS. It's also from federalnewsradio.com. John Koskinen now in as IRS commissioner. The vote was 59-36. I think that's more reflective of the tenor of the Senate right now than it is of Mr. Koskinen and his credentials. I've not been able to identify a single person in Washington, D.C. that has anything bad to say about the guy.
Yeah, you're not going to.
Yeah, I don't expect to. Has a following on both sides of the aisle in this city and is by all accounts, people like Senator Orrin Hatch saying you're the right guy for the job at the right time. Hard to find somebody who would be more predisposed to disagreeing with the selection of this administration and yet giving him that endorsement. But more so than Mr. Koskinen's selection in and of itself, we're at a phase where with this combination of 2 years into or coming up on 2 years into the second term of a two-term president and the ability of the Senate now to move more nominations, this turnover that we're seeing, the amount of people who are being confirmed, we're learning today at federalnewsradio.com that Joe Jordan's leaving the Office of Federal Procurement Policy job to go to work at FedBid. Mr. Koskinen's nomination's not the only one. Alejandro Mayorkas is now the number two at Homeland Security. Janet Yellen will be confirmed to lead the Fed after the first of the year. It's a tumultuous time for comings and goings right now, it seems, in the federal government, Roger. Is that something that you would expect to see continue after the first of the year, or are we just kind of in a bubble right now and we'll smooth it out for a while?
So I think where you are right now is that a lot of people have served 5 years at this point. And, you know, God bless them, I only made it four. It's tough to, you know, to keep going. And I think you'll see that naturally happen. You know, I think the average time typically has been 18 months, mm-hmm. you know, for appointees. And so just some level of turnover. So I think you're just going to see it continue through the rest of the second administration. I think it's easier for people to lock in the first administration. You know, 4 years, here we go. It's a lot harder in that second 4 years when they realize, you know, how much they've been doing for the last 4 years and maybe start thinking about what else they could be doing in there. And it gives opportunities for other folks to come in maybe with some new ideas. I want to touch on the point. I worked with John Koskinen in Y2K. I think every civil servant aspires to be John Koskinen, somebody who is, A, that effective. I love the quotes about Y2K. Well, it wasn't any big deal, was it? No, and I think John had an awful lot to do with mm-hmm. the fact that it wasn't any big deal. He's a very nice man. For somebody that's that effective, it's amazing that he gets everything done by being nice to people. Very smart, as you can imagine, and just somebody that is extremely well-respected all around the circles. My congratulations to IRS for having him there. Congratulations to the Senate for confirming him. You know, I know he knows what he's getting into, but God bless you, John. You know, yeah. This is going to be a tough one.
Yeah. The second most important federal news story of the week, in my choice, is from federalnewsradio.com. Senate confirms turnaround specialist to head IRS. And all the latest comings and goings are on federalnewsradio.com. All the people that the Senate is confirming and all the people who are leaving government, the very latest always on federalnewsradio.com. Back in a moment to look at the number one most important news stories of the week as selected by myself and Roger Baker, when the Federal News Countdown continues. Welcome back to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. The Federal News Countdown this week features the three most important federal news stories of the week as selected by Roger Baker and selected this week by me. Roger, we are up to
number one.
The top of the chart, the most important federal news story of the week, as you have chosen, is from FCW. It is headlined IT Reform Bill Introduced in Senate. It's by Adam Asmanian. And this has to do with FITARA. And I'm surprised, maybe not surprised is the word. I am. I'm surprised that everybody that I talk to universally, no matter where they are in the ideological spectrum, no matter where they are when it comes to industry or government, whatever, wants this to pass. They want this. People like this. And despite all the good feelings about what we'll talk about as my choice for the most important news story of the week, it didn't make it, at least not this time around. We'll look at it again in January. But... I don't know. Is it not? Did you think it's not sexy enough? It's not what? Why couldn't we get FITARA now?
Well, I think the near term is there was a fair amount of politics that occurred around the budget and the NDA and just getting those through. You know, at this point, and so I don't read a lot into the fact that they weren't in the things that were passed fairly quickly here in the last few weeks. There's been a – the reason I selected this one is that the real push for FATARA had been on the House side. You know, it had been with the ISA committee and Jerry Connolly pushing that forward and trying to bring the Senate, you know, along on it. You know, every bill starts on one side or the other. This mm-hmm. one started on the House side of things. I think with the events of the last few months, everybody has started to recognize that it's time for the next step forward along this path. You know, back when the eGov Act was passed in the early 2000s, I testified, you know, in front of the committee when they were looking at it, and one of my comments was, this bill doesn't go far enough, but it's a step in the right direction.
Mm-hmm.
For those that argue that FATARA doesn't go far enough, I would say, look, I could be the whole cheerleader of that. Nobody had more authority as a CIO than I had. I felt that it was extremely useful. But I'd rather see us take a step along the way and move to that path of getting CIOs more and more authority rather than wait for the perfect. You know, the old, the good is the enemy of the perfect. Let's, or the perfect is the enemy of the good.
Yep.
Let's get something done on this thing and move it forward. And it's great to see the Senate moving out on that side of it.
So then from my perspective, it sounds like you're saying be patient.
I think something will happen this year.
Yeah.
I really do. Exactly what it'll look like, I don't know. But there's a lot of recognition. I mean, think of the watershed event of the president talking about a website.
Mm-hmm.
To the American public. I mean, you know, not just saying, you know, when President Clinton announced FirstGov, you know, I mean, he mentioned the website, but it was very much a positive, now you can go to the website. This was an in-depth discussion by the president of what went wrong with a website. And I think what that really impressed on folks is technology is becoming so vital to every business process in the federal government that it's the sort of thing that we can no longer just leave to the folks that, you know, believe they know what they're doing. You know, we've got to make certain that we're adding all the professional oversight, all the professional work, you know, on this necessary to make it go well. That's the role the CIOs are supposed to fill.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether they do or not, you know, once you've got the authority, then you've got to carry through on those things.
Right.
But it's really hard to hold somebody responsible if you don't give them the authority to get the job done. So mm-hmm. I think this comes back around and says, okay, let's see how this works. But, it'll work better. It's got to work better than the way things are working right now.
Do you have confidence, though, that it will work? Because you could argue that Klinger-Cohen was supposed to do similar things, and agencies just decided, well, we're just not going to do it.
So I will start by making certain everybody understands my bias. I was the CIO at VA, and I'm going to talk about this. It really worked at VA.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the VA right now, let me just talk about one area that I think is the indisputable. The VA was failing at systems development in 2009. We used the authority of the CIO to implement an entire new process that says if you're not making your schedule, you don't have a project anymore. The VA makes, and I think the average over the last 4 years has been 83% of its systems development milestones.
So my question, pardon the interruption, my question is not whether the CIO authority scheme works, because I've seen the numbers that you had at VA, and you and I have talked about PMAS and the success that you had with it, and portfolio stats, we've seen the numbers on that. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about even getting to that point at the agency level where the other XOs at the agency say we're going to go along with this and we're going to let the CIO have that authority, because there's still a lot of agencies where the CIO doesn't have what you had. And that's where what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
If that doesn't exist already and Klinger-Cohen's been around for almost 20 years, what's to make us believe that by putting it in FATARA that it's going to make any difference?
So everything in government centers around the money. You know, do you control the budget? Do you control the acquisition? What authority do you have? You know, most CIOs have some authority to make things stop. The authority to make things go is harder. You know, again, I think FATARA takes us a ways along the path. It
mm-hmm.
doesn't take us all the way to where I'd like us to be, but it's going to inject the CIO much more in it. I personally believe that the CIO almost has to be a political appointee. The reason for that is that you want that CIO to be part of the inner circle team. You want the secretary to view that CIO as somebody that he or she brought on board, made promises to
mm-hmm.
When they came on board, and is somebody they selected. And you know, a lot of my colleagues don't agree with me on that particular thing. But having been in both, having been a career CIO and having been a political CIO, I can tell you it's like Thanksgiving. You know, if you say every CIO has a seat at the table, that's great. But there's a kid's table and there's an adult's table. And confirmed assistant secretaries sit at the adult's table in every case. You know, there's just a difference there.
Mm. Roger Baker's most important federal news story of the week is from FCW. The headline is IT Reform Bill Introduced in Senate. You can find that story and all of our Federal News Countdown stories at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth later today. When we come back, my choice for the most important federal news story of the week will wrap up this week's Federal News Countdown on In-Depth with Francis Rose. Be right back. We're back on In-Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. The Federal News Countdown this week features the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by myself and selected by Roger Baker, former CIO at VA, and now with Agilex, the chief strategy officer there. That is a pretty prestigious position, my friend.
I like it.
I don't blame you. My choice for the most important federal news story of the week is about the budget and the fact that we have a budget agreement in place. We have top-line numbers for the rest of this fiscal year and for fiscal 2015. And I am at odds somewhat with my colleagues and friends in the media on this, who have called this a mini deal and puny and all kinds of pejorative adjectives that describe something small. I think this is a big deal. I think it's a really big deal for people like you who are still in the government, who have some idea of what their life is going to be like for the next 18 months, Roger.
Yep.
Where we sat around and we're looking at a 3-week CR and a 3-day CR and a 2-week CR and then something for maybe 6 months at the most. For years we've been doing this now. And I see, maybe I'm too much of a Pollyanna. Maybe I'm too much of a glass half full guy. But I see a little bit of pressure on Congressman Rogers and Senator Mikulski to flesh out an omnibus in plenty of time for January 15th and then get to work in regular order, God forbid, on a budget for 2015 that we could look back potentially, if they don't blow it, and believe me, each party has figured out a way to step in it at some point in the past couple of years when it comes to the budget in particular. But it strikes me that we could look back in 2 or 3 years and say that deal in December of 2013 was when we finally turned it around and got back to doing this stuff the way we were supposed to do this stuff.
Well, let's not get too far ahead of ourselves.
Well, there's always somebody like you to bring me back to reality.
No, I agree with you. It's a big deal. And the reason I agree with you it's a big deal is let's look at what the alternative was. You know, we had that not occurred, right now we'd be talking about, there's only about 30 days until the next shutdown here. And everybody would be starting to ramp up. They'd be getting their plans back out for, you know, what did we see that happened in shutdown last time? How would we tweak that? How would we go at it again? So we could be, if you think about it as divergent timelines, you know, the timeline we're on right now is optimistically talking, as you did, about, wow, 3 years from today, this could be viewed as the watershed moment for when we really got back to doing real business. And we're only, a week and a half away from the, you know, where the timeline started to diverge.
Yeah.
But there's still a big deal in there, which is we're not talking about another shutdown. I mean, if you think about that timeline, a run up to a shutdown, a CR, a shutdown, a CR, you know, that would be just incredibly damaging to the ability of the government to get something done. In this case, I mean, everybody can get off and start executing on what they know needs to get done. Now, they've only got 9 months to get it done versus they're supposed to have 12, but at least now they got 9 months. It was May last year before they got their real budget numbers.
Yeah, and that's why I think that we sell this budget deal short at our own peril, those of us in the media who are explaining what this should mean to people, because in that context, 9 months is certainly not optimal. I'm not claiming that at all. But it's better than what agencies have dealt with the last couple of fiscal years, where it's been a shorter time frame than that. So there's a little breathing room here, and you think, well, geez, if we can knock this out by January 15th, and we can expect a president's budget request the beginning, middle of February, something like that. I mean, that's 6 months till we get to the end of September. That should give us enough time if they're really serious about wanting even if we look at it politically and they want to run on competence, hey, we are able to keep the trains running on time. We're not a total screw up like everybody thinks we are. And we're less popular than cockroaches, as Senator Reid said. If that's really where they want to go, then 6 months should be plenty of time to get 12 bills done.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm going to go back to just make certain everybody understands that the impact of actually having a budget from an agency standpoint. I think everybody, you forget that you build the scope and scale of your agency around doing work for 12 months. And so if you think about acquisitions, you think about, you know, on the IT side, building things up, you're looking at, you know, having the people to get a certain amount of work done in 12 months. If you compress that into six, that's what causes a fair amount of the waste in the federal government. Is, you know, I term, you know, September the rush to flush in the federal government, because if you don't spend it, of course, Congress isn't going to give it to you again. And so you better get it out there. But you haven't had enough time to really do the good job that you ought to do with the acquisition. And so, you know, a lot of things get pushed out the door, you know, to get them in place in that time period. If you give the agencies 12 months to do the work, I'm not saying that there will be no rush in September. I'm just saying it's an awful lot less you know, that occurs when they've had the time to really do the planning and get effective acquisitions out there.
Well, and it strikes me that it would be reasonable to expect that rush to be better planned, better executed, better planned, better thought out, better strategized, and then better executed.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when you see the inside of the agency when you don't get a bill until May, and you see what IT is trying to get done, what acquisition's trying to get done, September 30th staring everybody in the face by that time. You know, it takes a good 4 months to get an acquisition package all the way through, even when it's well prepared, to get it all the way through out to the vendors, the bids back, all the questions answered, do a good logical case with that. And so if you try and cram the entire year into that last 4 months, you know what you're going to get. You're going to get a lot of things that don't look as pretty as you'd like them to.
The most important federal news story of the week, as I've selected it, is the headline, Bipartisan Budget Agreement Clears Congress, and it's at federalnewsradio.com. All the stories on this week's countdown are linked at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth later this afternoon. We have a couple of minutes left, Roger, and since this is the end of the last federal news countdown of the year, I'm curious about your thoughts. I didn't give you a chance to really prep for this. But I'm curious about your thoughts as we look back over the entire year, what you think some of the most important things are that we've covered over the course of this year.
Well, certainly the most important one to me is Baker leaves government.
Of course it is. Of course it's the most important to you, Roger.
I am a much more relaxed individual these days. If that doesn't come across the mic, it certainly comes across in person. You know, the whole thing around the budget and the issues related to that, the shutdown, I think that's the most important thing. I'm a believer that, you know, there are pendulums on things, and we've gone back and forth between, you know, if you will, crushing the ability of the government to get things done and trying to allow that to occur. Sometimes you've got to go to the bad side in order to realize how bad that is and start pushing back to the good side.
Mm-hmm.
And so reflective on your point about how important could this budget deal have been, maybe, just maybe, on the political side, you know, Congress has realized that if you really do make it an environment where nobody can get anything done, then nothing's going to get done, including the things you want to get done.
Right.
If we push that far, then this could be a very positive thing, and that would be the most impactful thing that has happened over the last year from my standpoint. So I'm hopeful.
Yeah.
To your point there.
Well, that's the reason that I am hopeful, because I've heard from enough people on the Hill who say that some of the folks, both members and staff, and some of the other groups that were behind some of this. Enough folks are saying, wow, that really didn't turn out the way we expected. That really wasn't. We didn't get the result that we wanted from that. Enough people are saying that for a number of different reasons that I'm optimistic that nobody will want to go quite that far again. And that pendulum then, as you talk about, starts to swing back toward the middle, yeah, which in this case, the middle is things work the way that they normally work and are supposed to work.
And along that path, I think the same sort of thing with all of the attacks on career employees. I'm hopeful that sanity will start to reign on the Hill, and they will realize that taking those kind of cuts at the employees is effectively, you know, the old phrase of cutting off your nose to spite your face. It may be politically expedient and convenient to question why SESs get bonuses or, you know, question the performance of individuals in hearings, but the end result is impactful on the morale of the entire employee base, and without those employees, you're not going to get a darn thing done.
It's great to have you on the show this week, Roger. It's terrific. Now that we've broken you in on the countdown, we'll get you on here with another human so you're not stuck with just me next time.
I think we did all right.
Have a great holiday. Thank you very much for doing the show. Roger Baker of AgileX, my guest on this week's Federal News Countdown. All of our stories are linked at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. We'll archive the audio there, too, later today.